with blanks that police and prosecutors fill out every day to protect battered spouses and witnesses who were assaulted.
Marianne Grady Flores, would you do again, Marianne Flores Grady, what you did that has now led to the six-month sentence?
Well, I was basically a part of the support group that went there with eight Catholics. Because it was Ash Wednesday, it's a day of atonement in our tradition. And as Catholic workers, we went and we were...
we have 5 seconds.
I should say the group, the eight people, were
but
standing
Marianne
in the
Flores,
roadway
But Marianne Grady Flores, we're going
to
continue the discussion after the show,
the
and
signs.
We'll post it online. Marianne Grady Flores and Jonathan Wallace, thank you. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Want to connect KABU on your smartphone? Now you can with the free KABU mobile app available for both iPhones and Android devices. With the app, you can listen to KABU live wherever you are, continuously streaming whether your phone is locked or not. Listen to our latest audio uploads. See when your favorite programs come on with our schedule. Check out our community events calendar. Read our monthly newsletters. Everything is available in one place, including posts from our Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube feeds. You don't need an account to see what's going on at KABU. Have KABU at your fingertips anywhere you happen to be with our new mobile app. Look up KABU in iTunes or Google Play to download the free KABU mobile app.
Radio, live transmission.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kabu.fm. The time is 5:01. Stay tuned for the KABU Tuesday Evening News. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Milagro Theater, whose new play, Broken Promises, by Olga Sanchez, addresses teen prostitution in Portland. To find out more, you can visit milagro.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Beaverton police roll out their new body cams days after a fatal police shooting.
The Delta 5 protesters finished their trial. They blocked an oil train last year in Washington and were found guilty of a misdemeanor charge, but not guilty of blocking the train.
We hear voices from today's rally in Portland regarding the fate of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, January 19th, 2016. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. The Beaverton Police Department plans on open house this week to show off its new body cameras to members of the public. Meanwhile, the Beaverton Police on Saturday fatally shot Adam Karjalainen, aged 44. Officers reported that he charged them with a weapon, but his family says via social media that the facts are in dispute. The Beaverton police reported they were called to the scene to investigate an unwanted male. Once on the scene, officers determined no crime had been committed, so they left. But the police report says after officers left, they determined that a warrant was out for Karjalainen's arrest. The shooting happened after officers returned to the scene. They say that Karjalainen was armed at the time and, quote, advancing toward officers. No further information has been released in the shooting so far. Beaverton police plan two meetings on their proposed body cameras program. One is coming up Thursday, January 21st. The next is Thursday, February 18th, both from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Beaverton Police Department. The department won a federal grant to purchase the body cameras, and now they say they're seeking input from community members and leaders on how they should be used. The federal grant program requires the Beaverton Police to create a pilot project with policy to govern the camera's use. The pilot program includes community engagement, development, refinement of body-worn camera policy and procedures, researching, testing, and procuring equipment, deployment of cameras, and program evaluation. The Beaverton Police Department is located at 4755 Southwest Griffith Drive in Beaverton.
Multnomah County has proposed legislation that would raise civil court filing fees by 10% and traffic as well as parking citations by at least $5. The fee increases are designed to raise funds for the construction of a new courthouse on the west end of the Hawthorne Bridge, where iconic Portland restaurant Veritable Quandary currently stands. The county has already concluded a deal for the purchase and demolition of the restaurant, which was built in 1890 and is valued at just under $400,000. The new courthouse's construction is estimated to cost taxpayers approximately $290 million and is slated to begin in 2017.
An incident response program to deal with agricultural livestock health emergencies has been called in Indiana following the outbreak of avian flu. H7N8 is a highly contagious flu among birds that has affected nearly 300,000 turkeys and chickens in at least 10 commercial farms throughout DuBois County. Local and national health officials are working in coordination with local poultry farmers to contain and euthanize animals that have been tested positive for the strain. Although the exact tally is unknown, it is reported that over 150,000 birds have been ordered euthanized in just one facility. Prison labor has been conscripted for the job of killing infected birds working at a swift pace in cold, stormy conditions. Officials state that H7N8 virus has its origins in North America and mutated from a less pathogenic strain over time. H7N8 is different from the avian flu strain that prompted euthanizing of 48 million birds in 2015.
President Obama has declared a federal state of emergency over poisoned water in Flint, Michigan. Newly disclosed documents show public health officials at the city, county, and state level knew more than a year ago about the potential link between the Flint River water and a deadly outbreak of Legionnaire's disease that has killed 10 people so far. People using the water were only told of the potential link last week. The poisoning began after an unelected emergency manager appointed by Michigan Governor Rick Snyder switched Flint's water supply to the long-polluted and corrosive Flint River to save money. Governor Snyder delivers a state speech tonight in which he is expected to address this issue.
On Monday, here in Portland, the 31st annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast took place hosted by the Scanner News Organization to commemorate the life and activism of Dr. MLK. The keynote speaker was legendary civil rights activist Charles Bonner. Bonner was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, founded in 1960. KBOO's Joanne Hardesty spoke with Mr. Bonner following his speech.
I'm speaking with Charles Bonner at the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Scanner Breakfast for the 30th Annual Breakfast. I'm connected to the Black Lives Matters movement here. And there's a generational difference, but there's a lot of similarities between what's happening today in the Black Lives Matters movement and what you experienced as a young man growing up in this country.
The basic commonality is the fact that human injustice continues. And as long as human injustice continues, we must struggle against it. And the Black Lives Matters movement, is just a continuation of a historical struggle against injustice. As I frequently say, injustice never sleeps, and neither can we. And so we need more movements like the Black Lives Matters movement. People need to organize and coalesce and come together to stop the injustice against everyone, everywhere on the planet. And that's what I tried to address today in my talk, the importance of understanding the spiritual and, if you will, scientific basis for the oneness of all human beings, and use that oneness as a way to advance human rights and civil rights for everyone.
From someone in your position who was at the very beginning of the civil rights movement, what keeps you going? What gives you hope? What you have this optimistic air?
Yes. Well, what gives me hope is that things are changing. They're changing very slowly, but we are getting changed. When I was, as you see, 16 years old, you know, I could not go in the front door of a restaurant. I had to go up to the back and ring a doorbell and get my hamburger out of a Coke out of the fast food. Now we have a black president. We're talking about a period of 50 years. So even though things are moving slowly, they are definitely moving. And they're moving in the direction of justice for everyone. Women couldn't vote when African American men got the right to vote back in 1871. It took them another 50 years. Things slowly move in the direction of justice. And they only move, however, in the direction of justice if we get behind, put our shoulders to it, and push it forward. So what motivates me is the fact that I have to keep working for human justice, because that's a part of our DNA. That's a part of who we are as human beings. We are just people. It's just that they're people. They're those people who profit off injustice. And they're those people who want to separate us, whether it's men from women or blacks from whites or countries from each other. It's a false separation. They even want to separate us spiritually, the Christians from the Muslims and the Muslims from the Catholics, and these are spiritual frauds, because there is no difference between us, and that's the message we have to trumpet in advance.
It seems like there's like these systemic issues that we thought we'd won, right? We passed the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court recently gutted the Voting Rights Act. So we are today fighting a battle that you were bloodied for, right?
Yes.
The
yes.
exact same one.
Yes. And it goes to show that we can't ever relax.
Yes.
We have to remain vigilant, because those who are in power will take away our power, even those rights that we have won, unless we stay vigilant and unless we stay absolutely fierce in our determination to demand justice every day, everywhere. And so we can't be complacent.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now, when you were young, I know SNCC did freedom schools.
Yes.
Which were an opportunity for young people to really understand the danger they were actually putting themselves into, right? We don't do that today. Do you think we ought to bring freedom schools back?
We need freedom schools. We need schools that will train people in the nonviolent technique, that will train people in the art of politics, how to get elected officials, how to organize. SNCC taught us how to organize. We had presidents, we had communication committees, we had typing committees, we had captains, group captains, and we each had responsibilities. Well, we went out into the community and educated the people in the community. We had these trainings, as I mentioned, in nonviolent technique. Mm-hmm. We don't have those schools today. There seemed to be this idea that we are now free,
right.
But we are not free.
Yes.
And our rights are slipping away, like, you know, evaporating like cotton candy does in your mouth. And if
That's
we don't
right.
be very careful, we will lose them.
That was KBOO's Joanne Hardesty speaking with legendary civil rights activist Charles Bonner, an original member of the student nonviolent group known as SNCC. Also in attendance at the MLK Day Scanner Breakfast were a number of city and state officials. Here's an interview from KBOO's Jenka Soderberg with Oregon's Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum.
Hi, can I ask y'all? So this legislative session, are you going to be introducing measures to finally get rid of the landlord-supportive measures across the state that prevent rent control and other measures that could be done at the city level?
Yes, definitely. We're going to have more than one piece of legislation to promote affordable housing by removing that preemption on inclusionary zoning and many other proposals, too.
What kind of support do you have in the Oregon Senate?
I think that there's very strong support. It's clear that there's a crisis in Oregon that we've never seen of this magnitude, and we need to give people a roof over their heads and a pathway to both an affordable rental, if that's where they end up, or homeownership, and we're going to do something about it this session coming up in February.
How did it come about that we have such a developer-friendly state that is not supportive of tenants?
You know, I can't answer that. And in 1999, when that inclusionary zoning preemption went into the law, I voted no. The governor voted no. That's a long time ago. It was wrong for Oregon then, and it's even more wrong now. And I'm confident that we're going to do something about it this month.
Thanks.
That was KBOO's Jenka Soderberg speaking with Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum at the MLK Day Scanner Breakfast. MLK Day yesterday morning.
The Delta 5 trial involving the fate of five activists who blocked an oil train in Washington last year has concluded. We spoke with a member of the group today. Here's that interview now.
This is Jared Dantzler, KBOO News. I'm here speaking with Patrick Mazza, one of the Delta 5. Patrick, thank you for joining us on KBOO.
Oh, you're welcome.
Could you take us to the closing of the trial and conclusions that were drawn and your reflections?
We were found guilty of second-degree criminal trespass, but not guilty of obstructing or delaying a train. The jurors actually came out in the hall, some of them afterwards, and told us if they had been allowed to consider the evidence we brought before them, they would have found us innocent. They would have acquitted us on both charges.
How were they not allowed to hear that defense?
You know, this was the unique and history-making aspect of this trial, that for the first time in an American courtroom, civil disobedience defendants were allowed to present a defense of necessity. That means that we were allowed to argue that our actions were justified by the greater harm that would be prevented through our actions. And we were allowed to introduce expert witnesses on both oil train safety and on climate. And in this case, the jury was enabled to hear this testimony, but you need a second part. You need a jury instruction. The judge has to say, okay, these people have proved that their actions were necessary. It met the legal tests. Now you can consider this as you consider whether or not they're guilty of these crimes. And so the judge did not allow us to go through that second step because he felt the law, the precedents set before in the law, prevented him, a district court judge, the lowest level of judge, from overruling those precedents. Were we not able to make the connection was that there were no legal alternatives. Okay, so we made the other three tests. The first test was that we believed there was an imminent harm that needed to be prevented. The second test was that the harm to be prevented was greater than the crimes we were accused of. And the third is that we didn't have anything to do with causing the harm. So the prosecutor was trying to say, oh, well, everybody causes climate change, but the judge was wise in that regard. He recognized who really causes it is the fossil fuel companies. But that fourth one, no reasonable legal alternative. We just couldn't make that connection in the judge's mind. So So they were not allowed to consider necessity. You know, we are pursuing through the courts what we haven't been able to get through the legislatures because they're so tied up with fossil fuel money. I mean, this was one of the points we tried to make, that when we made the point about no reasonable legal alternatives, that really our political system has been tied up, has been blocked and bought off by the fossil fuel industry. I mean, now we know that they were doing their own research. Exxon, other companies were doing their own research back in the 80s. They had CO2 monitors on their oil tankers. They were running computer models. They knew exactly what their product was going to be doing to the climate. And they decided not to change their product line, but to lie, to conduct the most massive campaign of corporate disinformation that has ever been conducted. It makes tobacco look like a child's game.
Yes, this is groundbreaking stuff we're talking about, a necessity defense on behalf of the environment. And is there a chance through the appeal that this could reach a higher court?
Yes, definitely a chance. You know, so we'll start in Snohomish County Superior Court, but we'll move up the food chain. We'll move up to the courts of appeals. I mean, ultimately, you know, there's a fairly challenging precedent at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals level. That's the federal appeals courts that are just right below the Supreme Court. So we'll take it as far as we can take it. You know, using civil disobedience as a way to spur the public conscience. I mean, this now has to move to become a matter of conscience.
Where can folks turn for more information about the Delta 5, this ongoing struggle, and to reach out, support, and learn more?
Well, you can Google up Delta 5 trial, and that should get you to our website. And we also have Delta 5 trial is also a Facebook page.
Again, I've been speaking with Patrick Mazza, member of the Delta 5. The group has received a trespassing charge for their blocking of the mile-long train up in Washington, a back-in oil train. The judge was not able to hear their necessity defense, but they will move forward in good hopes with an appeal. For KBOO News, I'm Jared Dantzler.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO's News in Depth. We'll hear words from speakers at the rally here in Portland today regarding the date of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. This will be followed by This Way Out, an hour of queer and trans programming at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will bring us nearly a quarter inch of rain with highs in the upper 40s, lows in the lower 40s. Today in history, in 1809, the renowned poet Edgar Allan Poe was born in Boston, Massachusetts. He died at the age of 40 in Baltimore, Maryland. The quote of the day is from Poe himself. "The boundaries which divide life from death are at best shadowy and vague. Who shall say where the one ends and where the other begins?"
It's 5:23, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
The problem with applying conventional wisdom to political campaigns is that it can suddenly be upended by an unconventional campaign. National media pundits have been riveted on Donnie Trump's flagrantly narcissistic run for the Republican presidential nomination. But Exhibit A for the most remarkable political challenge to conventional wisdom is Bernie Sanders' totally unconventional, unabashedly populist run for the Democratic nomination. When the Vermont senator launched his campaign last May, the snarky Cognoscenti pronounced his effort DOA, Not a chance, they snorted, that a 74-year-old Jewish Democratic Socialist going against Hillary Clinton's powerhouse machine and daring to call for a people's revolution against Wall Street and reckless corporate elites can come close to winning. But oops, Bernie's authenticity and straight talk have mocked the cynicism of the wise ones and shocked the self-assured Clintonites. Huge crowds have turned out to hear and cheer Bernie denounce the chasm of inequality that's ripping America apart. Moreover, the same grassroots folks have made Sanders' run financially competitive. A record 2.5 million individual donors chipped in an average of $23 each last year to gird him with an impressive campaign fund of $75 million. And now, polls show that No Chance Sanders has surged into the lead among Democratic voters in both Iowa and New Hampshire, including taking a 12-point lead among New Hampshire women. Yeah, say the scoffers, but he can't win the general election. Oops again. In fact, polls now show he would handily defeat Trump, Ted Cruz, or Marco Rubio, while Clinton trails all three. This is Jim Hightower saying Bernie is defying the odds by showing that an authentic candidate with an authentic message can generate an authentic people's movement.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest news and developments in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. National Nurses United is enthusiastically backing the call of Senator Bernie Sanders for a Medicare for All universal health care plan. NNU Executive Director Roseanne DeMauro says it's finally a health care plan from a presidential candidate that will guarantee health care for every American. DeMauro says that the Sanders health plan would eradicate the crisis of the 29 million who remain uninsured in America. Hillary Clinton opposes the Sanders plan, arguing instead that the Affordable Care Act should be defended and perfected rather than taking the nation back into what she said would be a contentious health care debate. The Sanders plan would oust private health insurance companies from the system, replacing the current system with a Medicare-like plan covering everyone in the country. Fight for 15 workers are collecting signatures on their Fight for 15 voter agenda as they organize strikes and protests in the presidential primary states. The agenda calls for $15 an hour and union rights, affordable child care, racial justice, quality long-term care, and immigration reform. The National Employment Law Project says 64 million Americans make less than $15 an hour. The United Auto Workers are demanding that Michigan Republican Governor Rick Snyder release all documents related to the Flint water contamination issue to the public, regardless of any public records exemptions. The UAW says, quote, "No law that deprives the public clarity on this issue is moral or just for the citizens of Flint who are in peril and whose children are now at risk," end quote. The UAW Executive Board says it's proud of hundreds of UAW members throughout the country who have come forward to distribute water and filters to Flint families struggling with lead-contaminated drinking water. The poisoning of Flint's water was done by Governor Snyder's appointed emergency manager, who changed the source of the city's water to the polluted Flint River. Governor Snyder addressed the state legislature in Michigan last night. Protesters were calling for his resignation. More than 800 alumni from Wheaton College have told the Illinois Christian School they'll consider withholding financial support unless termination proceedings against Professor Larisha Hawkins immediately cease. Dr. Hawkins became the target of termination proceedings after donning a hijab-like scarf and declaring solidarity with Muslim women who wear the hijab.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the 50,000 members of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, representing aviation's first responders and last line of defense, charged with the safety, health, and security of the passengers in their care. Information on how the AFA-CWA improves safety, pay, benefits, and working conditions for its members is online at afacwa.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Yesterday, airport workers across the nation staged protests calling attention to what they call poverty wage jobs, which have caused concerns over public health and safety. Demonstrators targeted Alaska Airlines as well as airport contractors to demand fair pay. The protesters in Portland acted in solidarity with similar protests in Boston, New York, Newark, Philadelphia, Miami, Chicago, and Seattle.
On Martin Luther King Day, this is very important that the information get out that what we are trying to do, increase wages, better benefits for people here at PDX. And not only for Huntley, but for all the workers that are not unionized, who are making minimum wage or no benefits. We want to come together and make sure everyone is being paid what they deserve and help this place be a better place for all the people who work here.
That was a PDX International Airport employee speaking about the protest which took place yesterday. For more, we spoke today with another employee of PDX.
To start off with, we want better standards, better training, equipment. We want dental. We want to be able to work just 40 hours a week and be able to take care of our families and not having to rely on the government for assistance. A lot of us are in poverty and would like to improve a lot of stuff. The airlines make millions to billions of dollars in profit, and here our airport is number one 3 years in a row through Travel and Leisure magazine. And because of them being number one is because of all of us hard, dedicated workers showing up every day and giving them our all.
Have you received any response from the airport administration in response to your calls for higher wages?
We have not heard any response back from Alaska yet. I still have to look into that and find out what is going on and what the response is back to regarding us at the rally yesterday, and hopefully things look good. I'm hoping.
I learned that y'all were protesting in solidarity with other cities around the United States. I wonder if there's been any cross organization between the airports and personnel.
Well, obviously, yeah, there's seven others that are protesting as well, and slowly and surely everybody's making a statement, and some people have succeeded in getting better wage, but they're still fighting for union, as you know, one of the companies at our airport, Huntley's, just became union. And so we're hoping that we can, for my company that I work for, hopefully as the next runner-up, to make this happen.
So your collective decision to hold this rally on Martin Luther King Day, and finally steps moving forward for you and the union.
Because it's one of the most wonderful days has inspired a lot of people for standing up for their dreams and their beliefs. And it's obviously a nationwide holiday, and we figured, you know, why not? It would be one heck of a way to get the word out and have people hear us.
Again, I've been speaking with Julie Hayden, a member of Local 49 SEIU, employee of the PDX Portland International Airport, who was out there protesting yesterday to call for fairer wages. For KBOO News, I'm Jared Dantzler. Peace negotiators representing the Colombian government and the FARC, F-A-R-C, rebel group requested the United Nations send in an observer to facilitate peace between the two conflicting groups. The announcement was a major breakthrough in an armed conflict that has lasted since the mid-1960s. The mission would span a period of 12 months and involve the use of international unarmed observers acting as unbiased and uninterested third-party monitors. Although details of the disarmament and ceasefire process remain uncertain, the announcement comes as a significant move in peace talks that aim to wrap up sometime in March. Both parties have expressed hopes that, unlike previous ceasefire attempts, the UN involvement in the conflict will help bring about a genuine and lasting peace.
A prisoner exchange with Iran resulted in 11 people freed from prisons Saturday, 7 Iranians from U.S. prisons and 4 dual citizens from Iranian detention. A 12th person was also released, though separately from the swap. The Americans freed include Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian, former Marine Amir Hikmati, and a Christian minister, Saeed Abedini. The prisoner exchange comes amid a week of rapid diplomatic events. Tuesday, the Iranian military intercepted 2 U.S. Navy boats in their territorial waters and detained 10 U.S. sailors. They were released the following day. By Saturday, the International Atomic Energy Agency certified that Tehran had in fact met its requirements to curtail its nuclear capabilities under the Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. then announced that sanctions against Iran were lifted, allowing the country to engage in the global market and gain access to more than $100 billion frozen in overseas accounts. But just after a flight carrying 3 of the released American hostages left Iran, the U.S. Treasury Department announced a new round of sanctions, this time on less than a dozen specific groups and people allegedly involved in Iran's ballistic missile program. FSRN's Nell Abram talks with Sarah Shord, one of 3 U.S. citizens detained by Iran in the summer of 2009 when they strayed across the border while hiking in Iraqi Kurdistan. Shord spent 14 months in solitary confinement in an Iranian prison before she was released in 2011.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Tuesday, January 19th, 2016. Palestinian family members injured due to settlers' attack, and troops invade West Bank communities and kidnap civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian family was attacked on Tuesday by Israeli settlers near the northern West Bank city of Jenin, Palestinian sources reported. According to local sources, all family members were in their car at the Barta'a Jenin Road when they were attacked by armed Israeli settlers. Witnesses told local media that the group of armed settlers came from the Dotan illegal Israeli settlement near Barta'a village. Medical sources said that all family members, including 2 children, sustained cuts and bruises and were moved to a hospital in Jenin due to the settlers' attack. In other news, Israeli forces kidnapped on Tuesday 16 Palestinians during invasions and home searches targeting communities in occupied West Bank. In Nablus city in northern West Bank, Israeli troops searched and ransacked homes before kidnapping 5 civilians. Meanwhile, 4 more civilians were kidnapped from the nearby city of Jenin. Also in northern West Bank, Israeli troops kidnapped 1 civilian during home searches in Tulkarem city. In southern West Bank, Israeli forces invaded the districts of Hebron and Bethlehem, searched homes and kidnapped 4 from Hebron and 1 from Bethlehem. 2 more civilians were kidnapped during home searches that targeted areas in occupied East Jerusalem, local sources reported. In related news, the Israeli military court in Jerusalem decided to postpone the trial session of Ahmed Manasra, 13, until mid-February. Manasra was critically wounded and his cousin Hassan, 15, was killed by Israeli armed settlers last October after they were accused of trying to stab settlers in an East Jerusalem settlement. A video on YouTube showed Manasra wounded on the ground and settlers attacking him and troops refusing to allow medics from providing him with medical care. According to the Palestinian Political Prisoners Center, PPS, the Israeli army is trying to keep delaying the court of Manasra until he turns 14 this weekend. The Israeli army prosecutes Palestinian children from the age of 14 and above as adults. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, January 19th, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imamc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Maui and me, Ghassan Bandura.
Listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Caden Schlesinger, Paul Roland, Jim Lockhart, Joanne Hardesty, and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Jared Dantzler. Special thanks to Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 is Democracy Now! At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, Political Perspectives features an interview with historian Lawrence Shoup, whose new book, Wall Street's Think Tank, is a study of the Council on Foreign Relations. Shoup describes the CFR as the most influential private organization in the country and traces how it connects major U.S. corporations with government, academia, and media. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Chris Siegel hosts the KABU Food Show. Thank you very much for listening to KABU, and thanks KABU members for your generous support. If you aren't currently a member, you can become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Nicole.
Good night, Jared.
And stay tuned now for KABU's News in Depth.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
As the Malheur Wildlife Siege marks its 18th day, there is still no sign that the Federal Bureau of Investigation or any other federal agency plans to stop it. The Oregon FBI has not posted a statement about the occupation since January 3rd. Their website sends reporters to the homepage of the Harney County Sheriff's Office. However, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association last week issued a statement clarifying that the FBI is, quote, in charge of making and implementing plans to end the siege. The KABU News is waiting for a callback from the local FBI office on that. Meanwhile, supporters of public lands demonstrated at Holiday Park in Portland today, urging the federal government to protect the Malheur Wildlife Refuge from destructive acts by the armed occupiers there. KABU reporters Jim Lockhart and Paul Roland were there and captured this audio from speakers at the rally. We begin with Congressman Earl Blumenauer's aide, Liv Brumfield. We then hear from a member of the local Paiute tribe, Jarvis Kennedy. Finally, the Audubon Society's conservation director, Bob Salinger, reads a vision statement for the Malheur Wildlife Refuge.
The congressman says, "Good afternoon. I'm sorry I can't be here with you today to speak out in support of public lands and the many benefits they provide for all Americans and the natural environment upon which we depend. The situation that has unfolded at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Harney County is appalling and deeply troubling me. There. The militants who are illegally occupying and destroying refuge property must be held accountable for their actions and the damage they cause. Yeah. But they're not only destroying refuge property, property that belongs to all of us, and changing the landscape that is so important to the land's native inhabitants. They also risk the erosion of important relationships between refuge staff, Native Americans, the surrounding communities, and conservation interests. These collaborative relationships, built over years of hard work, benefit the cultural heritage and wildlife within the refuge and have also provided the local community a significant voice in management of these federal lands. So the militants' actions are contrary to what Oregonians, including the residents of Harney County, stand for. In Oregon, we practice collaboration and partnership, not might makes right. They need to leave, and now. They should not be made into martyrs. They should be fairly prosecuted to the full extent of the law. He goes on. We all derive great benefit from public lands. They hold significant value for local communities and across the nation in terms of traditional uses, cultural preservation, fish and wildlife, and outdoor recreation. Whether it's for habitat protection and recreational activities as this refuge provides, or whether it's for employment, tourism, outdoor recreation, or simply taking in the beauty of the landscape, our public lands provide tremendous economic, recreational, and ecological value to our society and improve our quality of life. They should be protected and celebrated, not taken and held hostage. Thank you.
Next up is Jarvis Kennedy with the Burns Paiute Tribe.
Hello, my name is Jarvis Kennedy from the Burns Paiute Tribe.
Hi, Jarvis!
Thank you, people, for supporting this cause right here. You guys are awesome. I thank you guys for being here. Buddy needs to go home. We just need to stand together and stay strong. Keep it peaceful. Sooner or later, he's going to get cold and go home. He loves, you know, the Harney County winters over there. So, like I said before, who knows what would happen if it was me and my Native brothers that took up arms and occupied a federal building.